Knowledge Products presents The Giants of Philosophy, Socrates, narrated by Lynn Redgrave, Part 4.
Socrates' questioning may seem negative or destructive, but Socrates apparently regarded this approach as a powerful way of searching for moral truth. The road is not an easy one, however. No single Socratic argument suffices to show us the way. Because Socrates refutes his interlocutors, all we are left with is the knowledge that the interlocutor has failed to maintain a consistent position or to sufficiently define some moral term. But Socrates claims that looking at our views critically is indeed the most important thing we can do. He regards it as a religious mission. According to Socrates, the most important thing we can do may be to lead people to understand the limitations and inconsistencies in their beliefs.
Perhaps someone might say, why can't you just go away from us and live a quiet life, Socrates, without talking? Well, for some of you, this is the most difficult thing to persuade you of. But if I tell you that to do as you say would be disobedience to the God, and therefore I cannot be quiet, you won't believe me and will think I am being insincere. And if I go on to say that this is the greatest good for a human being, to talk every day about virtue and the other things you hear me discussing, examining myself and others, and that the unexamined life is not worth living for a human being, you will believe me still less. Well, this is what I say, but it is not easy to persuade you of it.
Even if no single argument or no single answer can tell us what we need to know, Socrates seems to think that living the examined life can at least improve our ignorance. One way to do this is to follow Socrates in undertaking a lifelong mission to examine our moral beliefs. In this, we would examine not only the beliefs among ourselves and among those who agree with us, but also the beliefs of those who disagree with us. Such a mission would include reflecting seriously about how we should conceive of things like justice, piety, happiness, virtue, and other moral concepts. Socrates seems to think that such persistent examination might improve our understanding of things. At least we might discover which ways of thinking cannot be made to work. We may never know exactly why they can't work. That would require the kind of knowledge that Socrates himself claims to lack. But we can realize that certain ways of looking at things are not tenable. Some points of view cannot be coherently defended, no matter how hard we try. An excellent example of such an unsuccessful attempt occurs in Plato's dialogue entitled Gorgias, which was almost certainly written at the end of Plato's Socratic period. Here, two distinct interlocutors attempt to defend the idea that it is better to do an injustice than to have an injustice done to you. Socrates disagrees, arguing instead that it is better to be the victim than the perpetrator of injustice. In the Gorgias, Socrates first refutes a young man named Polus. Then the more radical Callicles proclaims what he believes to be the most fundamental moral truth, that goodness is nothing but pleasure. But Callicles soon finds his arguments crumbling under Socrates' logical onslaught. In fact, he is plainly defeated in the argument, but Socrates does not taunt his adversary. He simply explains his own position, which is that the only way to avoid appearing ridiculous is to believe that justice is always preferable to injustice.
These things, which have been made apparent to us in our earlier arguments, as I say, are held down and fastened, if I may put it in a somewhat boorish way, by reasons of iron and adamant. So at least it seems so far. And if you, or someone more vigorous than you, doesn't release them, then no one who speaks in a way other than I now speak can speak well. What I say is always the same, that I do not know how these things are. But of those I happen to meet, just as now, no one has been able to speak otherwise without being ridiculous.
Living the examined life allows us to discover that certain ways of thinking, when they are critically examined, always end up being ridiculous. Some views can, and some views cannot, be defended by reason. It's clear that Socrates himself does not think the examined life has gained him any substantial wisdom. Even at his trial, he characterized himself as really worthless in regard to wisdom. And though he occasionally defends certain specific moral claims, he never proclaims definitive knowledge. He never claims that he can provide the definitions that he so often challenges his interlocutors to produce. Wisdom, it seems, is something only a god can have. For humans, the best wisdom possible is to be aware of the fact that we have no real wisdom at all. This human wisdom, as Socrates calls it, will preserve us from the great errors of arrogance and pretentiousness. It will keep us from thinking that we are superior to others, when in fact our superiority is nothing but a sham, a supposition that we know what we really do not know. As for the rest, we must live and act as best we can. We must follow whatever path reason seems most to support. Such a life cannot be free from error, but it is the best a human being can do. Socrates was notorious among the citizens of Athens as a man of paradoxes. Those Athenians whose pretense he attacked often accused him of being an aeron, that is, one who is insincere, ironical, and full of specious arguments. Many Athenians and many others in later times have doubted that Socrates was sincere in claiming to have no wisdom. This skepticism was especially common among those who found him irritating, and Socrates surely was irritating. Even he realized this. At his trial, Socrates ironically claimed that his tendency to irritate people was one of his finest attributes.
I am making my defense not for myself, as one might think, but for you, so that you will not make a terrible mistake with the God's gift by voting against me. For if you put me to death, it will not be easy to find another who, to put it in a rather absurd way, will attach himself to the city by the God as if it were a horse, which, though large and of good breeding, is somewhat sluggish due to its size and needs to be stirred by stinging. I think the god attached me to the city for just this sort of thing, and I never stop rousing and persuading and chastising each one of you throughout the day, wherever I find you.
Many generations of Plato's readers, right up to the present day, have found Socrates' stinging questions to be driven by more than the ignorant puzzlement, he claims. Socrates just seems too good at his job. He catches others too easily in contradictions and perplexity, all the while claiming to lack wisdom. He says he does not have the knowledge that others claim, yet he is the one who is relentlessly effective in revealing their intellectual shortcomings. Many readers have therefore believed that the Socratic claims of ignorance are nothing more than an ironical pose. They amount to a pretense that's used to entrap his victims and then to subject them to his stinging remarks. Many have wondered, if Socrates does not already know the answers, how could he be so effective in finding just the right questions to ask? In the first book of Plato's Republic, an extremely hostile young man named Thrasymachus breaks into a discussion Socrates is having with another young man named Polemarchus. Thrasymachus directly accuses Socrates of treachery.
What kind of nonsense is this, Socrates? And why do you two simpletons give in to each other like this? If you really want to know what justice is, Socrates, don't just ask questions and then subvert any answer another gives. Since you are clever enough to have discovered that it is easier to ask questions than to answer them. But go ahead and answer yourself and tell what justice is. Explain clearly and precisely whatever you say, for I won't accept any blathering generalities from you.
Socrates replies,
Thrasymachus, don't be so hard on us. If he and I have made mistakes in our reasoning about this issue, please understand that it is not willingly that we have gone wrong. For you shouldn't think that if we were looking for gold, we would never willingly give in to one another and make concessions in our search in such a way as to ruin our chances of finding it. But then, when we are looking for justice, a thing even more precious than lots of gold, we would be so stupid as to make concessions and not, instead, be as serious as we can be about discovering it. You mustn't think that, my friend. But you see, we are inept. It is more fitting for a brilliant fellow like you to take pity on us then, rather than to give us such a hard time.
By Heracles, here is the famous irony of Socrates. And just as I knew and predicted it, when it came time for you to reply, you would refuse and be ironical and do anything rather than answer some question that someone might ask you.
For Thrasymachus, the claim of ignorance by Socrates is really a type of intellectual cheating. He seems to ask questions for which he already knows the answers, just to trap people and make fun of them. Is Thrasymachus right? Should we be skeptical of this eccentric philosopher? It is Socrates' sincerity that we will examine next.
This is the end of part 4. Please download part 5 to continue.